Broadcasting from Manhattan Beach and the World Wide Web, you're listening to CHSR, HealthyLife.net.
As a service to our listeners, this program is for general information and entertainment purposes only. CHSR HealthyLife.net does not recommend, endorse, or object to the views, products, or topics expressed or discussed by show hosts or their guests. We suggest you always consult with your own personal, medical, financial, or legal advisor.
Welcome to HealthyLife.net, Positive Talk Radio. I'm Dr. Marilyn Singleton, and welcome to Health Freedom Now. Keeping our health freedom of choice alive is so important, especially when it comes to our skin. Like they told us in medical school, the skin is the largest organ in the body. Today I have as a guest Dr. Kathleen Brown, and she's a clinical dermatologist. She graduated from the College of William and Mary in Virginia, majoring in biology and music, and she earned her MD degree from Eastern Virginia Medical School and had residencies in both dermatology and internal medicine. The other wonderful thing about Dr. Brown is she mentors other dermatologists who are interested in direct pay practice and networks with others who have an interest in free market solutions to our health problems. Welcome to the show, Dr. Brown.
So good to be with you.
Well, I'm just going to get started with you, something I like to ask the guests. So all the listeners know doctors are just regular people. What got you interested in medicine?
Well, I had a hard time deciding what I wanted to do. I was struggling and searching for what I wanted to do. But I was one of those people, well, I don't know if there's many, who said, no, I'm not going to medical school when I was a biology major, but I kept being fascinated with it. And then I decided literally one day, I just decided I'm doing this. And I loved medical school, especially the academic part, the first part of it. I just loved the science. So that's it.
Well, it's kind of interesting because so many people say, oh, I got through the first 2 years, all the biochemistry and basic science, and just jumped on it. Suddenly, when they got into clinical medicine, it's like, okay, I've found myself. So we're all so different.
I love school. I was like, what am I good at? I'm good at school. So, yeah, adjusting to the clinical part was actually harder for me.
Well, it's funny because you're such a good clinician and so likable and your patients like you. So, hey, we can't let them know the truth. You love the academics.
I grew to love clinical medicine, but at first it felt like, you know, a fish out of water.
Well, I'd like you to just explain a little bit of the anatomy of the skin. I mean, people see all these ads on TV for skin lotions, and they say, well, it gets down to the layers and all this kind of stuff. Tell us what these layers of skin are and how does skin connect with the whole system of the body?
Well, I'll be straightforward about the basics. The epidermis, of course, is the outer layer. And it can have five layers to it, but usually it has four, which you see under the microscope when you do pathology, which is a big part of dermatology training. And the outer layer is composed of keratin. It's dead skin cells. They were alive, and they've been transformed into dead skin cells, and they're meant to keep things out as well as keep fluid in, so it is hard to get medicine through those layers when you are doing topical treatments. So, you know, these ads that miraculous things, it's actually hard to get things in. And so that protects us. That keeps, like some, like say a frog, for example, has a different sort of a skin and is more susceptible to, or a fish, to things in the environment. And so that protects us. And then under the epidermis is the dermis, and that's live skin. It's got, completely live. It's got nerves, blood vessels, all of these different components. And it can be different thicknesses based on age, based on male or female. And then under that, we call it subcutaneous, you know, under the skin, but it's really kind of part of the skin. It's really a fatty layer. And, of course, that's very important, very metabolically active, too. So there's the three layers. They're different in different parts of the body. Like the palm doesn't have any sweat glands, for example. You have hair-bearing skin, but actually most of our skin is hair-bearing. You just have very tiny hairs in most of the skin. So, yeah, that's your basic anatomy.
Okay, now you said one thing. You said the palms don't have any mm-hmm. sweat glands. So how do people get sweaty palms?
I don't have any hair follicles. I'm sorry, I misspoke. Don't have any hair follicles. They do have sweat glands, which is the eccrine glands. They don't have any what's called a pilosebaceous. I'm sorry, I misspoke. Thank you for catching me. So, yeah, no hair on the palms or the soles. So that's kind of interesting.
Well, that is sort of interesting, huh? It makes me think of that old thing that said young boys would grow hair on their palms if they did something that I won't say.
Oh, okay.
You might be too young to remember it.
Yeah, so, no, sorry for misspeaking on that. I was just speaking quickly, not careful.
Okay. Now, what in general causes skin problems? You know, we have skin problems that seem to come internally, skin problems that come externally. Can you say what cause, is there any one cause or just multiple causes like other medical conditions?
Well, that's a complicated question. But
that's why I'm here, Dr. Brand.
So skin cancer, people think that it's just caused by sun, and it isn't. I mean, it's kind of like lung cancer is not just caused by smoking. People are shocked if someone has lung cancer and they didn't smoke, but it's true. There's people who get lung cancer who didn't smoke. There's skin cancers that occur in areas that virtually never get sun, and so that, and when we sun, we're mostly talking about ultraviolet light. But so that's why people should be aware that to look at areas like, well, the sole is the most common area for melanoma in dark-skinned people. There was recently something on TV. I had a little bit, speaking of misinformation, about melanoma being underdiagnosed in darker skin patients. I think that the reason for that is, even though it's a rare thing, is that it's in a place where people don't look. I do look. When I do a full skin exam, I look at the feet. Let me wait. I get that information out there. Melanoma can occur on the bottom of the foot. And you think, well, did I sunburn there? No. I mean, so there are other causes. But ultraviolet light has been well known for a long time. Will cause mutations in our skin. It's energy, and it breaks the gene, and which is the control mechanism in the cell, and so then growth becomes disordered. But our body has repair mechanisms for that. So very rare skin condition, very bad skin condition, xeroderma pigmentosa, for example, is when someone is not able to repair and they start getting skin cancers from a very young age. So that mechanism is well understood, but it's not the only mechanism for skin cancer. So skin cancer is disordered cell growth, loses the inhibitions on growth, and you get, cells that don't know when to stop, basically. And so that's when you get tumors. Other causes of skin condition. I think some of the skin conditions are quite complex, things that we've struggled with treating for years, very typical dermatology issues, psoriasis, eczema, acne. They're complex in their causation. There's generally mixes of environment, maybe hormones, genetics. And so teasing that out has been important from a basic science standpoint in terms of looking at what treatments are. And treatments are evolving there, but they're still quite imperfect. So
I, on TV, I keep on seeing these ads for some, it looks like it's some sort of antibody treatment for psoriasis. It's not a topical, it's some sort of shot people get, have you heard of that, used it?
Yes. So
what is
psoriasis?
It?
You know, we were stuck for years. We had things that worked, but they had a high level of toxicity or very difficult treatments. And in the last, I'd say probably 20 years, roughly, just we have numerous treatments for psoriasis, and they're quite effective. But they are systemic treatments, and they will block a particular receptor. They have various different categories. A lot of times the one that is, they're very expensive. A lot of times the one that ends up being chosen is based on which one that the patient's insurance will cover. Many, many thousands of dollars a year. And so initially people thought, wow, that's really an ethical issue of why are we spending that much? But, I mean, that it's very mainstream now, and so there are a lot of choices. But they are systemic medications, and some of them might have a contraindication. Somebody might be a bad candidate for it because they have another health condition. And you might, for example, history of skin cancer like melanoma. You might say, well, this particular drug is not a good choice for this person because it might increase their chance of their cancer coming back. But we do have many more options there, and that's a good thing.
I remember as a child, the ads that were on TV, they called it the heartbreak of psoriasis. And, it's kind of, once I got older, once I went to medical school and saw these psoriasis lesions and people say, oh, it doesn't matter what I do, I just can't get it to go away and it's itchy and scaly, and it's good to know that there's some systemic medications now that aren't so toxic. That,
and like so many chronic skin conditions, the range of the condition can be from very mild, such that people don't have it diagnosed, it doesn't bother them that much, all the way to extremely severe and, yes, heartbreaking, horrific, hospitalized, sick. So, I mean, that's the far end, and most people have it milder, but it's on quite a spectrum, so it very much needs tailoring to the individual and their other health conditions and their personal preferences and how much it's bothering them.
Well, I'm going to ask you about something. It seems simple. I don't know if it is, but it's ubiquitous, is athlete's foot. It seems to be, I remember that's the first thing I heard about when I went to high school and we had to go to gym class and take showers after gym, and everybody says, put something on your feet so you don't get athlete's foot. Fortunately, I never got it, but tons of people have it. What is it, and what can people really do about it?
Well, it's caused by a type of a fungus called, the class is dermatophyte, which means, it's Latin, it means skin plant. It grows on skin. And it's the same class of fungus that causes what people call ringworm or fungus in the scalp, tinea capitis. It causes all these different types of things. But on the feet, again, a lot of times people don't even know they have it. Sometimes it's terribly itchy. Sometimes it's very chronic and not particularly itchy and just scaly. But it's contagious. And it also, the same fungus will get in toenails. It's much harder to treat. It used to be that we had very little treatment for athlete's foot. We now have excellent treatment for athlete's foot. often available just over the counter. So some of the things over the counter are older medicines that are not as effective, but some of the really effective medications are available over the counter. The thing about it, though, it's already in your shoes, so you can catch it again from yourself.
What do you do about it? Is there some spray or something you can put in your shoes?
There are medicated powders to put in a shoe, and controlling sweating is helpful. Wearing socks is helpful. Washing the socks, I suppose, on hot water. People used to say white socks. I don't know why. But, to separate your skin from the shoe, you don't want to throw out all your shoes, usually. Usually just people treat it, and if it starts to come back, they treat it again. For most people, it's pretty easily treated. There are some people where it is more refractory and more extensive, and some people end up having it not only on their feet, but also, again, on their body, what's called ringworm, sometimes very extensively. And in that case, sometimes people will be treated with an oral medication, and we have good oral medications now.
Well, since I mentioned athlete's foot, I have to tell you my grammar school joke about it. If athletes get athlete's foot, what do astronauts get? Oh, here goes. Mistletoe.
Oh, that's cute. That's cute.
My listeners know I'm very corny, so there you go.
Oh, gosh.
So, here's another one that I see a lot of ads for over-the-counter things, warts. What are warts, and do the over-the-counter things work?
Oh, I'll say one of my favorite things I say to patients, I hate warts. The reason I hate warts, I'm not afraid of them. It can be a major treatment challenge, and I think practically any dermatologist would tell you the same. But sometimes they respond extremely well, and sometimes no matter what you do with them, they just won't go. And so, yeah, that's the art of medicine. There are things you can keep trying. Sometimes people make their peace with them and say, okay, I'll live with that one. But, yeah, the over-the-counter things, typically a very strong salicylic acid in, like, a plaster, a little pad, and those are good. And the nice thing about those is they, again, block contact with, like, your shoe, so you're not spreading it around in your shoe. I actually did have warts when I was a kid, and I was, I think, in seventh grade, and I had them on my heel, and I didn't tell my mother because, I don't know, I was embarrassed or didn't know what they were. And yeah, went to the doctor, they kind of dug them out. So, but with success, and I realize in retrospect that I was very lucky because they can be hard to treat. But yeah, the topical things available are generally salicylic acid, and there are quite a few other things that dermatologists can do. But I think attending to them early is a good idea. Most of the time that generally works out. We freeze them a lot. That hurts. We use liquid nitrogen. It's adults generally prefer something like that, like get it over with. But sometimes they still come back. Sometimes it needs to be repeated frequently. And then there's all sorts of other things that dermatologists will do if those basic things are not effective.
Well, now, are warts that people get on their skin a virus? Is it the
yes.
same thing like venereal warts, the same virus?
It's the same class of virus, human papillomavirus, HPV, but often different serotypes. They have little subtypes, just like there's different cold viruses. So the ones on the skin most of the time are not precancerous, with some exception. There's some rare conditions where people are very, again, have an immune defect. They're very, very prone to getting many, many, many warts. You know, there are these stories. I think there was a man in the Philippines, like trying to remember the nickname, the tree man, something like that. Horrific, life-ruining warts. So he had an immune problem, and there was an international effort to help him. But most wart viruses are not precancerous. They're just an annoyance, and often they will go away on their own. We do all these things to try to get rid of them, and sometimes some of their nose at us, and then sometimes they just go. And this is a very interesting thing, I think, in terms of our immune system, that sometimes you can treat one, and somebody may have many, and then they all go. It just triggers them to go. And I did have that happen with someone who had many, many, many warts in a very difficult location, very miserable, and had a lot of other illness going on. And I treated like one or two with freezing, and he came back, and he wasn't alive long after because he had other very serious illness. But illnesses, but he came back just to show me, look, they all went. So our immune system can be a surprise and a puzzle at times.
It sure can. I think that's interesting you bring that up, because there's so many other things where your immune system comes up, where you get sick with one thing and then you're going to get something else, or it's just like getting the common cold, where somebody in the household has it, but you don't get it because you're feeling good, you're not depressed, you know, things are going well in your life, and you don't get the cold. Turn around the next time, you're run down, you haven't had enough sleep, and you're the one that gets the cold. Same virus sticking around your house, but one person doesn't.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and the immune system plays an essential role in so many skin conditions. Psoriasis and eczema, again, are examples of that. The interaction, the genetics, the immune system, they're not really considered autoimmune. That's a different thing, but immunity plays an essential role in those conditions.
Well, when we come back after the break, I'm going to quiz you a little bit more. I'm very interested in this. I had eczema growing up, and every now and then when I get nervous, it'll pop up. And so yet again, one of those things where your whole body is all interconnected and you can't just separate everything out. But I'd like to talk about hives and acne. These are all things that everybody gets, or at least a large percentage gets. And so we'll talk about that after the break.
To some, a baby's babbling doesn't mean much, but it does, especially if there's no babbling at all. Little to no babbling by 12 months or later is just one of the possible signs of autism in children. Learn more at AutismSpeaks.org. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
Faucet running? That's not a faucet. That's a river rushing through the forest. Forest rivers provide over 100 million people with clean water to drink.
What? I can't hear you because of the vacuum.
That's not a vacuum. That's the trees in the forest cleaning up the air we breathe.
I didn't know the trees were so amazing.
Yep, and the forest gives us shade, trees to climb.
That's awesome. Let's go explore some more.
Visit the forest today and enjoy all it does just for you. To learn more about the forest and find one near you, go to discovertheforest.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
This is the book every woman needs to put into their home library. Women's Body, Women's Wisdom by Christiane Northrup, MD, covers the entire range of women's health from the first menstrual period through menopause and everything in between. This fully updated version includes the very latest treatment and research data combining new technologies with natural remedies and the miraculous healing powers within the body itself. It's one of the best medical reference books on women's health, and you can get Women's Body, Women's Wisdom by Christiane Northrup, MD at Amazon.com.
Hi, I'm Lindsay Sterling, and I know what it's like to struggle with mental health issues. If you have a friend that's going through a tough time, now's the perfect moment to reach out. Learn how to start the conversation at seizetheawkward.org.
Brought to you by the Ad Council, the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, and the Jed Foundation.
Uplifting Talk, HealthyLife.net.
Before the break, we sort of beat up eczema and psoriasis, some of these things that are itchy and dry. I'd like next to talk about hives. So many people get it. Sometimes you know where it comes from. Sometimes it seems to come out of nowhere. What are hives and what can we do about it?
Well, hives, we talked about anatomy. Hives are in the dermis. You get edema, you get swelling. Edema is, you know, swelling, fluid, but generally considered to be an allergic reaction. But sometimes we can't figure out what someone is allergic to. And so that's when we call it idiopathic, meaning we don't know. And it's actually pretty common and extremely frustrating. So very itchy.
Well, some people, now it's kind of a rash, some people get the big wheals and welts and where it's just awful. What can you put on it? And are there topical things, systemic things? Does Benadryl work?
Well, systemic Benadryl, which makes you sleepy, can be quite effective. We have acute hives, which usually people know what set it off. You know, they ate, you know, a peach and they're allergic to peaches, or they had a medication, classically penicillin, and they should avoid that in the future if they have that type of reaction. But it's acute, and the medical term for the lesion, the thing you see on the skin, is a wheal, W-H-E-A-L. It's puffy. It doesn't have any scale, and it's a little usually round or sometimes larger. And then the chronic idiopathic urticaria we were talking about on the break, which is often pressure-induced. People feel they can't wear clothing that's got elastic. And but there's a whole range of causes of hives, but it is often considered to be an allergy. And topical can help, but hives tend to kind of move around. They don't stay put like psoriasis or eczema. You know, it's, you know, if you put a pin mark around it, it's not in the same place 12 hours later. That one's gone and another one's popped up. So that makes it hard to treat with topical medication.
Now, if somebody gets hives, should they worry about having anaphylactic shock, having their throat swell up and be unable to breathe? Is there a correlation between those two things?
Well, that would be context. So most people who have hives do not have anaphylaxis. Anaphylaxis, of course, is a life-threatening allergic reaction. But hives can be part of anaphylaxis. And that's generally acute. Somebody eats, you know, classically a food allergy, but sometimes a drug allergy, a medication, over-the-counter or prescription. And then that's part of a serious syndrome where people have wheezing, trouble breathing, can have a sudden severe drop in blood pressure. It can be fatal. We've probably all seen that during our internship, during our emergency medicine days, but most hives are not part of anaphylaxis, so that would be context. If you have localized hives, again, what we call urticaria, generally you're not worried unless you've got some other symptom or you know you had something that may have caused it. And if you did have that, of course, you need to be directly to the emergency room. People who've had prior history of anaphylaxis, a bee sting, for example, you know, may carry an EpiPen for that type of an emergency. But most hives are not anaphylaxis, thank goodness.
Okay, good to know. Now, the next thing I want to ask you about that's the plague of teenagers and some adults is acne. I remember girls in high school, I never wore makeup because my mother never did, so it just kind of wasn't in our armamentarium. But I remember girls would slather on the makeup to cover up acne, and my mother would always say, you know, when they put the makeup on, it makes it even worse. So what can people do about acne, and do they have new things that are out now since the many moons ago when I was in high school.
We have new things. We could use more new things. There's some new topicals, and you and I both know about insurance companies denying and excessive prices if you're paying cash. But, I mean, there are some new things, but I've been in practice long enough to see the pendulum swing on treatments. We really could use more new things there that are effective. You know, the most effective thing that we have is, used to be called Accutane, brand name, isotretinoin, has some potential serious side effects. It's very carefully monitored. So that's for the farther end of the spectrum, but it is the only thing also that we often consider to be a cure, and it's not always a cure. Sometimes it is. Sometimes people never have significant acne again. We use hormonal treatment, sometimes the birth control pill for females, spironolactone for females, which is also a pill that's been around a long time used for treating other things, and it's, I think it's still off-label, what we call off-label, but well-established. So that's one, but it's systemic. So we have these systemic things. Of course, we have antibiotics. Acne's not an infection, but some antibiotics have quite a bit of good effect, but they don't cure it. So then we worry about what are the side effects of the antibiotics. So, you know, that's one of the things that is still evolving. What are our current guidelines on that? Current guidelines for antibiotics are generally shorter-term use, and pick one that is safer and use it in low dose for usually in the tetracycline family. Doxycycline is one. It has a potential side effect of making you sun-sensitive. So there's quite a bit of... Yeah, that's where you need the doctor to be involved because of the potential side effect and the monitoring and what's a good choice. And then we have the topical things. Oh, go ahead. Yeah.
No, I was just going to say, now you said that acne wasn't a bacteria, even though you used antibiotics. Well, what causes it?
It's not an infection. It's not contagious, but bacteria are involved. There's bacteria that live in the hair follicle, and... So then there's an inflammatory response, then there's hormones, there's increased sebum, which is kind of an oil that's produced in the pilosebaceous, which is the hair follicle oil gland, not a sweat gland, but it is the disease of the pilosebaceous unit, which is the hair follicle on the face. And so, yeah, it's again, it's what we call multifactorial. There's multiple causes. It. And so we kind of attack those different areas. We attack the bacteria part. We attack the clogging of the hair follicle with things that will unclog and cause those cells to fluff inside the hair follicle. So, yeah, there's a lot to know about acne.
Oh, certainly a lot of young folks are plagued by it, and it does seem to go away in most people once they get older. And
most people, yes,
yeah,
not everybody.
Some, you know, some older people have it, but
yes.
Hey, there's one of the many trials of teenagerhood. Never to go back there again. Well, after the break, I'd like to talk some more about cancer. You mentioned it early. And I know you specialize in this, and people have moles all over the place and are worried, are they cancer? And there's different kinds of cancer, the kind that older people get, and some are worse than others. So I'd like to go through all those things after the break.
Keyboard Cat, Hamilton the Pug, and Toast Meets World. These are some of the internet's most beloved pets. And they all have one thing in common. Their stories started in a shelter. Start your story. Adopt a dog or cat today. Visit theshelterpetproject.org to find a pet near you. Training that pet to play the keyboard, that's optional. Start a story. Adopt a shelter or rescue pet today. Brought to you by Maddie's Fund, the Humane Society of the United States, and the Ad Council.
In the small town of Elmira, New York, a boy was born into an all-American family. The odds of him achieving his dream in the fashion industry? 1 in 23 million. The odds of having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 110. I am Tommy Hilfiger, and my family is affected by autism. Learn more at autismspeaks.org/signs. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
So what's a great way to spread awareness that driving high is illegal everywhere? A catchy song, of course.
You can run, but you can't drive high. You can run, but you can't drive high.
Friendly reminder, don't drive high. If you feel different, you drive different. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
I wasn't prepared to be a caregiver to mom. I had no idea how hard it would be and what I would need to know. Things I never thought of, like how to improve her mood and ways for me to stay positive. Luckily, I found the Caregiving Resource Center from AARP. It had articles about the basics, but also information about the hurdles I was facing. Caregiving Resource Center at aarp.org/caregiving. Articles, tips, and tools to help you both care for your loved one and care for yourself. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
The Bright Side of Talk. HealthyLife.net.
Before the break, I was asking Dr. Brown to discuss cancer with us. She mentioned it earlier briefly, but this is something that is a big interest and a specialty of hers, and she does surgery for, and I'd like to go into the different kinds because we see the kind that, you know, always seems to be an old man has it on his bald head, and then there's the one that looks like a mole that's melanoma. So, Dr. Brown, I'd like you to kind of stepwise go through some of these cancers and how bad they are and what you can do about it.
Well, the good news is most skin cancers are very curable, and they're more easily curable when they are detected early. So I think people need to know a little bit about the warning signs of skin cancer. And then if they have something that they're concerned about, do get it looked at by somebody who really does know what they're doing. In general, I would recommend a board-certified dermatologist, although there's other people who do know what they're doing with it, too. Warning signs, something that bleeds, that doesn't heal, that bleeds. You know, sometimes people see a little drop of blood on their pillowcase, and maybe it's something on their ear, and maybe they can't really see anything on their ear yet. That should be looked at. The most common thing that does that is basal cell carcinoma, very common skin cancer, hardly ever kills anybody, although with some exception. But it destroys tissue, and it gets bigger. It grows slowly. It doesn't always bleed. It has a lot of different appearances. But sometimes people don't take it that seriously because it doesn't hardly ever kill anybody, but very common on the face. And ear, and it can, again, can be quite destructive. So if someone lets it go, they, you know, their nose can be very badly damaged, for example. So that's one. And there's a variety of different treatments, and one of the more common is the excise. We cut it out. The face heals beautifully if it's done properly. Often people will not feel like they've got a scar, you know, because it hides well. Squamous cell carcinoma. There's squamous cell carcinoma of other organs, but when we're talking about skin cancer, it's of the epidermis. It's an epidermal cancer. And when it's detected early, highly curable, but we have respect for them. They can spread to other, to lymph nodes and other parts of the body, and then they're very hard to treat. And they can grow fast. So they tend to be tender to touch. They can have a precancerous phase that can be very long-lasting, but somebody develops a tender lump or growth, they should be seen quickly. And, again, these are very common cancers. By far the most common cancers that we see are skin cancers. And then the third of the common ones is melanoma, the least common but considered the most serious, also very curable if caught early, has a wide variety of appearance. often looks somewhat like a mole, but it has an irregular shape. It grows. Sometimes it doesn't have color. It can be pink or it can be white. So that's where if someone has, in terms of warning signs, if you have something on your skin that looks different than the other things, what we call the ugly duckling sign, it should be looked at, especially if it's changing, even if the change is slow. So those are the three common ones, and then there are rare ones, and there's actually one more serious than melanoma called Merkel cell carcinoma, usually in older people. Again, it's kind of a little lump that starts out, has a very, very high risk of spread to other parts of the body, and then there's some others that are more rare. So biopsy of skin to get a firm diagnosis is a very easy procedure almost all of the time, so people should not hesitate if they have something that they're concerned could be a skin cancer to get it looked at, and if the doctor recommends a biopsy, it's generally an easy procedure. Now, when you go to get a biopsy of these things, can you go in and at the same sitting do get a wide excision of the lesion and that be a cure? Well, that very much depends. Depends on the doctor's practice. I mean, if it's something that's easily removed right away, and for example, a squamous cell carcinoma, it's small. Often in my practice, I would biopsy and fully remove it at the same time because time's of the essence. That gives you your high cure rate. If you're not sure what it is or it's larger, there's a lot of times, or you want to send somebody for specialized treatment called Mohs surgery, or you do that specialized type of surgery, often for basal cell carcinoma, biopsy will often be done followed by definitive treatment later on. For melanoma, and again, depends on the size of it, the location of it, the suspected depth of it, the method of biopsy might be different. Biopsy might be fully removing it, and yet a further surgical treatment might be needed based on the depth of it. So you can see there's a lot of subtlety, a lot of knowledge required in tailoring diagnosis and treatment to that individual in their particular situation. Well, should people do about moles? I mean, sometimes new moles pop up and you think, oh my goodness, is this a melanoma? What do you do when you see a new mole pop up? Well, new moles are more common in younger people, and they should look like a normal mole. A lot of what people call a mole is not a mole, and then there's other things that are moles. What we mean in medicine, in a technical term, is a nevocellular nevus. It's made of mole cells that are pigment cells. We have pigment cells throughout our skin, but when you have a small tumor, a benign tumor of mole cells, that is a mole. And so most of them are absolutely fine, and most melanomas develop on their own, not in a mole. But it's that main warning sign again of if it looks different than the other ones, or it looks odd, it's not symmetrical, it's not a mirror image of itself. It's growing. It has, you know, pink in it as well as brown in it. Anything that looks like, okay, that one is outside the normal, that one doesn't look like all the rest, then I get that mole looked at. And, you know, the feelings about whether, I would say feelings, the opinions about whether moles should be removed or not has very much evolved over time. And we also have ways of monitoring ones that are what we would consider low risk. You can take a very good photograph. You can use a tool called a dermatoscope. And you can evaluate, is this mole likely to be a problem or not? Most moles are not problems, but never to sit on one, never to ignore one that is changing or looks odd.
Well, this is good to know, and it also says there's times that you really do need to go to a specialist when you talk about special equipment that it can kind of tell these moles apart. I certainly never heard of that in medical school, and not being an internist or dermatologist, this is the first I've heard of it, and it's good to know, and I'm sure it's the first a lot of people have heard of it, that if you have questions, go to a dermatologist. Yes, and then there's some people who are just covered or have a lot of very odd moles, what we call atypical moles. So that's the syndrome, and it's a marker for an increased risk of melanoma. So those are people often that are followed at regular intervals.
Well, quickly before the break, since you're talking about things plopping up on the skin, what are freckles now? Are freckles, do they have any increased risk of anything?
A freckle is generally, they're usually people who have freckles have many freckles. And there's genetics and sun exposure involved, often on the face, but sometimes on the other body. Usually very fair-skinned people, people who don't have a lot of pigment, but sometimes not. And they're not the same as a mole at all, even though they're color. But they're usually kind of like a background pattern instead of an individual spot. It's kind of like a pattern on the skin. But people who freckle easily, again, increased risk of skin cancer. It shows that they are not people who kind of tolerate as much sun exposure and are more at risk for damage from the sun.
Well, this is such good information to know. And when we come back for our last segment, I'd like to talk about another interest of yours, and you've brought it up a couple of times, is the concept of cash medical practice. And we're going to get into that in our last segment because it's so important. And yes, it has a lot to do with dermatology and treatments. So we'll discuss that after the break.
I know you care about your right to health freedom of choice, but we are under constant attack by industry-driven medical mandates. At MAM.org, you can be part of the solution to keep your rights to health freedom. MAM stands for Millions Against Medical Mandates, and your voice is heard and counted. Visit MAM.org, where doctors, lawyers, journalists, researchers, scientists, and people like you come together to keep our health freedom strong. Together, join the millions at MAM.org. That's MAMM.org.
Hey, hon, what you doing with your phone?
Do flowers have best friends?
I don't know.
Hey, look.
Whoa.
Some answers can only be found in nature. Discover the unsearchable. Visit discovertheforest.org to find a trail near you. Brought to you by the United States Forest Service and the Ad Council.
To some, a baby's babbling doesn't mean much, but it does. Especially if there's no babbling at all. Little to no babbling by 12 months or later is just one of the possible signs of autism in children. Learn more at autismspeaks.org. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
You're listening to CHSR Real Radio on the web.
Before the break, I was talking to Dr. Brown. Of course, we talked about a lot of common skin things. And something she mentioned a couple of times was, if the insurance approved medicine X or medicine Y. And we've talked about this on the show so much that who's in charge of our medical care? You? The doctor? No, the insurer. Well, Dr. Brown, her other passion other than skin, and I don't mean skin flicks, is cash medical practice and free market systems for medicine so patients can get the treatment that the doctor thinks is best. And I just like Dr. Brown to discuss it and some of the problems that come up and why these things are rejected and all that kind of stuff. So let's get into that, Dr. Brown.
Sounds good. Yeah, and we say cash. Of course, we mean cash or check or credit card, but the question is, who does the doctor work for? Of course, the doctor should work for the patient. And we have these middlemen, we have the insurance companies, we have the government payers. And when they're paying, of course, they have to have some sort of a say. And we don't like them having a say, but we're spending the money that has already been pooled, and so they have rules about it. And so my practice that I have, I think ideally, we, for most
medical treatment, we have reasonable prices. There's always people who cannot afford even the most inexpensive medical services or other things, and we always need some form of a safety net, whether we can debate whether that should always be private or be public or whatever. That's debatable. But we do have both public and private safety nets. But it's like we're all in this so-called safety net, and we shouldn't need a safety net for most things. We should, you know, if we have a critical illness, have a bad car accident, God forbid, or a very, very serious illness, then that's what insurance and safety nets should be for things that we can't ordinarily just pay for out of pocket. But I found that there were I learned from my patients, so many people who have very high deductibles with their insurance, or they don't have insurance, or they have something that they want that is reasonable that is not going to be covered, for example, by Medicare. So there's a huge opportunity to serve those people better by providing a reasonable price. And then the other niche is even when people have what they would consider to be excellent insurance, they might not be able to get an actual board-certified physician, which they may want. They might not be able to get in a timely manner. So there's a huge, I'd say, niche, but it's a big niche to be filled in providing high-quality service for a reasonable, predictable price. And that's what my practice in Oregon for almost 8 years, and now I'm just starting up in Montana. But that's, I'm a big believer in that, and I help other physicians who would like to do that, particularly in dermatology. And it's very popular amongst patients. Not every patient. It's not going to be for everybody. But, and it's not just wealthy patients at all, and that's my experience, not just an idea, so that people can pay directly for their care. They can ask, do I really need this done, doctor? If I need something more expensive, can you refer me? Of course, we can figure that out. So it's freedom, basically. It's more freedom in the purchase of health care, of medical care, and more autonomy for patients and for doctors.
One of the things that's very interesting about this whole cash, and when we say cash, again, like you say, check, credit card, but just outside of the insurance system using this kind of medical care, they've done surveys, and 70% of patients say that they are willing to pay just to see the doctor they actually want. And now that they have these networks that are getting narrower and narrower, and you've got a doctor, and then suddenly now that these private equity things are buying up doctors' practices, magically, one day now you can't go to that doctor anymore. They're not in the network.
Oh. But you may feel that you're paying twice. I mean, some people, they will have a copay, what they pay at the time of directly to, you know, this, set by their insurance company, that may be close to the amount that they're paying to see a doctor on their own. But you do feel, as a subscriber to the insurance, that it's a ripoff. I know I have definitely felt that myself, and my husband and I went outside insurance. You know, we were, I'll say, harmed by Obamacare. We could no longer find a decent, affordable insurance, and we went with health expense sharing associations. We've had three different ones at this point, currently on Samaritan. And you feel that it's a ripoff, this high deductible, and then you can't choose. And then when you get in there, like with dermatology, people waited a long time for their visit. They might have eight things on their list. Oh, we can only see you for one thing or two things, and that has to do with the whole coding system that is owned by the AMA. And so, it almost sounds like a conspiracy theory, except that it's true. So, with the direct pay, I mean, I love it. People come in, they've come a long way, they say, I've got eight things, you know, and I was like, well, let's look at your list and use your time well, and let's see if we can get to all of them, which is often completely possible. So, you know, why limit people? The reason for limiting is you're not getting, you're playing a payment game. And so I'm sorry, it feels like an immoral game, and yet we're all kind of mostly all stuck in it.
But when you're in that system and you're contracted with insurance and participating with Medicare and Medicaid, that's the game you're playing. You have to. So you can't just do what's best for patients. It, you know, you may go bankrupt. I mean, you can't. You can't do it that way. It's not, over time, it has become impossible to just do exactly what is best for patients when that system. So then once you realize that, you start feeling like that you need to get out of that. And I think for patients, something you mentioned when you talk about having a big list that the doctor needs to go over and the way this whole coding thing works is it's one at a time. There's a huge opportunity cost to patients. Take time off of work, get babysitters, find transportation, whatever it may be. And 100%. Even though you're paying with cash, if you get it all done at once, that's 4 babysitters you didn't have to pay, or 4 times you didn't have to seek a day off from work and, you know, have your employer turning up their nose at you. So there's bigger opportunity costs to the way the system works. Yes, I 100% agree with that. Elderly people who are coming from a couple hours away who don't drive anymore, and their son having to take off work. So, and then when they get in, they may have several things that are actually quite important and can't wait or shouldn't wait.
Well, I tell you, Dr. Brown, we've had a great discussion on skin and health freedom, and that's why we're here, is to let people know how they can help take care of themselves. And when you have to go to a doctor, go to a doctor. And if it's somebody who is a cash practice, you know that you can get a good price and get exactly what you need without having to go through the insurance company. So thanks for coming on the show. This has been wonderful.
It's a pleasure. It's great to talk about subject I love.
Oh. And for my listeners, as I always say, quoting Dr. Albert Schweitzer, each patient carries his own doctor inside him. We are at our best when we give that doctor who resides in us a chance to work. Thanks for listening.